We've been for these last few weeks now looking at these precepts. How do we live together in community in terms of not taking that which is not given, honoring life, honoring each other, telling the truth, and staying clear-minded. In other words, how in community do we go about living the last three aspects of the Eightfold Path, which is wise or right speech, action, and way of life. In the Buddha's grand scheme of things, one of the things that I found so refreshing about when I first took up Buddhist meditation practice and also really began to get serious about scholarship in the realm of Theravada Buddhism, one of the things I found so appealing about his teachings, the way he presented them, was that he didn't, as is the case in a lot of other traditions, when he began to teach at the very start, he wouldn't say, well, you think this is how things are, but this is really how things are. What he would do instead, before he would begin to teach, is to say something along the lines of, abide contemplating the possibility that this is so. What I'm about to tell you may resonate with your own experience. If why you are on the spiritual path is the same reason I went on the spiritual path, was to find out why there is suffering and how it might be brought to an end. Okay. If that is your goal, then what I discovered and what I teach may be something that you want to check out. And if you do find that these teachings resonate with your own experience and seem to have the same effect for you, then by all means, you should follow them and you should investigate more deeply and you should know these practices, right? But he taught it more, the phrase he used, ei passako, come see for yourself. Come learn whether or not what I'm teaching is literally true for you and something that you want to use as some guidelines for how to live your life. So as he taught, where suffering comes from, and it's when we speak or act with a mindset imbued with attachment, aversion, or delusion, that we create suffering for ourselves and other people. That when we speak or act with beneficial intention, then just the opposite happens. It's conducive to the cessation of suffering rather than the prolongation of suffering. If we can remember the Dharma Chakra, the eight-spoked wheel, right? Three of the spokes are about meditation, concentration, and effort, and mindfulness. And when you're capable of seeing clearly, begin to apprehend the wisdom factors, insights into all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who you are up to this moment. And then that's right understanding. And then right view or right thought, right thought, sometimes called a right intention. Insight into the intentions that arise in the mind before you speak or before you act. And then, so those are the fourth and fifth, and then the last three spokes are speech, action, and way of life. Where the Buddha said the freedom lies is in this interaction, this interface between intention and action, or between intention and speech. Because if you can become mindful of your intentions before doing either of those things, it'll make it less likely that you speak or act in a way that is going to be harmful, right? Because you've gotten some insight into where you're coming from. So certainly true with regard to how you speak to other people. And the Buddha had these guidelines for how to do that. So if you want to speak in a way that is conducive to the cessation of suffering rather than the perpetuation of suffering, then here's a little checklist you may want to go through before you engage the tongue, right? A way to check out your intentions before you speak. Excuse me. There are five of them that he taught at various times. The first is your speech beneficially intended? Is the intention of your communication to do good? Is it constructive? Is it undertaken with beneficial intention? Trying to do something good? Or not, you know? Is the speech, instead of beneficially intended, perhaps intended to harm, or intimidate, or frighten, or hurt? What underlies the speech? Why are you speaking in the first place? So, is it beneficially intended or not? Second one, is it useful? Does it have a useful purpose? Or is it just idle gossip? And that's one that's really worth paying a little bit of attention to, you know. Why are you engaging in speech with somebody else? Okay. Is there a useful purpose to your doing so, or is it just because you're nervous with too much silence? You know? I would notice especially when I was learning cultural anthropology, and we were paying attention to stuff like this. Like when you get into an elevator, for instance, and there's somebody that, you know, that you've never met before, and you're trying to make some kind of connection, or standing around the lobby or somewhere, and so one or the other of you says something, oh, well, you know, nice weather we're having, or isn't it really lousy weather we're having, and it seems so banal, right? Can't you really come up with something better than that? Well, in the realm of social anthropology, that's really pretty important speech, because it's somebody that you don't know at all, and almost every culture, when encountering a stranger, has some gesture or some means by which you simply acknowledge the existence of the other and what we have in common. So this is an acknowledgement of the existence, the presence of the other, and noting something that we have in common, which is our environment. Okay. So that can be very useful speech, actually, even though it doesn't necessarily seem like it, because it's all about initiating some kind of contact. So, is it beneficially intended? Is it useful? Is it truthful? Is your speech intended to convey that which you know or believe to be true? Or if for some reason or other, are you fooling around with the facts just a little bit? You know, and emphasizing some things and leaving others out, you know. Are you intending to try to create some sort of impression that may be something a little different than how you think things really are? So, is it beneficially intended? Is it useful? Is it truthful? Is it timely? All the above things that I just mentioned might be in place, but it might not be the right time to say whatever it is that's on your mind. So being attuned to flow and what seems to be the right place in speech is pretty important. And then lastly, is it kind? Is it kind words kindly spoken, or is it harsh words harshly spoken? All the other things, the first four, can all be in place. But if there's a real kind of rough edge to what is being said, it can wind up having, you know, exactly the opposite effect from what you had hoped. Okay. So those are all things to keep in mind before you speak, because it really enhances the likelihood that your speech is going to be beneficial, and it's not going to create further suffering for yourself and others. It's just as important, in my experience, when it comes to listening. So if you listen to somebody else talking to you, or talking in a group, and you keep those criteria in your mind, it can give you a lot of insight into what's going on in their mind, in terms of what their intentions are, where they're coming from, and what they're trying to accomplish. If it feels to you like they are trying to do the same thing you are, in terms of that checklist, you know, if most of those characteristics in place, then what that begins to tell you is that person holds similar values, and they're trying to work with speech in the same way that you are. So it's kind of like two people in the elevator talking about the weather. Through your style of speech, through the way you speak, through the way you hear them speaking, you start to get some idea of what's going on in their minds. Likewise, if their speech, in your view, fails to meet any of those criteria, that's pretty important information too, as far as where they're coming from. Yeah, you know, wish you well, or whoever it is that they're speaking to. And you need to be mindful of that in terms of sort of boundary setting, you know, and discerning, you know, whether it's even necessary to be talking to this person in the first place. So, really, really important and useful teachings. What I wanted to focus our attention on this evening, however, is to kind of experiment or play with applying those same criteria for wise speech to how we communicate with ourselves. And that involves both the content of the voices that we hear speaking to us, and also the tone of voice, or the quality of voice that we use. So when we're able to apply mindfulness, you know, really careful listening to those inner voices, it's a rich trove of information about what's going on in our own mind. Whether we are feeling kindly and compassionately toward ourselves, or whether we are judging ourselves harshly, whether that internal voice in a particular instance is in fact harsh words harshly spoken. And one of the things that I've started doing a lot when I listen to those inner voices, especially if I'm engaged in sort of harsh self-judgment, and that thought will arise, just ask myself, is that true? Is that really true? You know, am I really as much of a schmuck as I think I am? Or is it possible I'm going a little overboard here? So I messed up somehow or another, and I actually did do something that was kind of unskillful, and I actually did cause some consternation for myself or somebody else. Then comes the question of what do you do about it? How do you regard yourself when you become aware of the fact that you've done something or said something that's really kind of off the mark? And as difficult as it can sometimes be, it's really, really important and really useful to especially pay careful attention to those messages you send yourself, or the tone of voice that you use when you are being particularly self-critical or highly remorseful, for instance, or feeling a lot of guilt or shame or whatever, and you hear those messages coming at you and you hear the tone of voice, how you listen to them and how you respond to them is oftentimes the key to whether or not you're going to be able to be free of suffering. If you find yourself often engaged in somewhat negative or critical self-judgment, basically that's a form of self-aversion, right? And does it feel good or does it hurt? Well, it mostly hurts. Except for the fact that if there is some little element in there that says, oh, well, I really deserve to smack myself around, right? So that sometimes it can be just a little pleasurable. It's like I'm atoning for my sins by beating myself up, right? So there ought to be virtue in that. Well, not actually in Buddha Dharma, there's not. There may be some religions where there is, but this isn't one of them, right? In fact, the Buddha used this very poignant simile for self-aversion. You know, if the discursive mind decides that you're doing all these things that are causing suffering and that's why I suffer, well, why can't I stop doing them? And then every time you do something that causes further harm, then you just find yourself feeling even more self-aversive than you did before. The Buddha said, that's like a dog with a collar around its neck, chained to a post. And the dog is lunging away from the post as hard as it can, trying to get free. Okay. And all the dog is really doing is hurting its neck. You know? And the harder it lunges, the more it tugs, the more it pulls, okay, the more harm it does, and the more it hurts. That is the way the Buddha describes self-aversion. That it does no useful function. There is no useful purpose whatsoever in that activity of the mind, okay, except to cause dukkha, except to cause pain. So the Buddha said the way to cease harming yourself in that way is to cease feeling self-aversion. Easier said than done, of course. It's a reflexive habit of mind. Right? Oftentimes when we feel the self-aversion, it's because we did something that we really consider to be wrong, and maybe others have told so. And so as a result, we feel guilt or shame. The Buddha, in going over these, you know, afflictive emotions that happen, especially in the wake of something where you really do feel like you kind of blew it, that there's a real distinction between feeling guilt and shame on the one hand or feeling remorse on the other. And what do you imagine he pointed out the difference between those two things being? Thank you. Basically, guilt and shame are mental products of the discursive mind. Okay. I did a really bad thing. I really screwed up, and I am ashamed of myself. They're generated by ego. Because that judgment is coming from a place of me as a permanent and abiding self. Okay. I am no good. I've never been any good. I screw up like this all the time. I'm never going to improve. You know, I. That's a form of I making and me making, which, as the Buddha said, is how we generate suffering. If, however, instead of thinking of yourself as a permanent and abiding self, but rather, as the Buddha taught, what's going on in the mind is that you create self on an ongoing basis, on a moment-to-moment basis, you know, when he was offering his teachings on not-self, on anatta, okay. And there were the raging philosophical controversies at the time, for the most part, were between what are called the nihilists and the eternalists. The eternalists was the extant religious tradition of the time, which talked about reincarnation and rebirth, and if you really play your cards right this time around, you may be able to get born in a higher caste, and then eventually you'll be able to become one with Brahma. Okay. The other side, the nihilists, said, you die, that's it. Ain't no more. And they accused the eternalists of propping up, you know, their view as a way of keeping the caste system propped up as well, you know, because you fulfill the duties of your caste and, you know, do what the Brahmins tell you to, and maybe someday if you really play your cards right, a few lifetimes down the road, you'll be reborn as a Brahmin, and then you can become one, you know, with Brahma. So they would keep hammering on the Buddha, which is it, which are you? And he would never answer them, and they'd go away in disgust. And so then one of his followers would say, well, you know, which team are you on here? You didn't answer to the satisfaction of any of these people who put these questions to you. He said, he would say it's because they weren't asking the right questions. You know, they, from the way they were asking their question, I knew they could not hear the answer. As he said, the self cannot be said to exist, nor can the self be said to not exist. The self exists when the mind creates it. The self does not exist when mind is not creating self. Now you see it, now you don't. When we're feeling guilty or ashamed about something we did, mind is creating self. And it's the self that feels the guilt or feels the shame. If you're coming from this alternative understanding, then you can see that whoever the person was who said or did the unskillful thing is somebody very similar to, but not the same as, who you are in this moment in time. It was who you were in that moment in time that did that act, that did that deed, that you feel bad about. Okay. The way remorse is different from guilt and shame is that when you, it's not a matter of not taking responsibility for any harm you may have caused. It's taking complete responsibility for it. But you're seeing what you did in a very different way. You're looking back and saying, oh my goodness, how deluded of me, or how afraid I must have been, or how angry I must have been at the time that I did what I did, or that I said what I said, or how desperate my longing may have been. You know, I was really, you know, dukkha, that word, you know, mostly translated suffering, really means dissatisfaction. It means, or it's also translated doubt, which is difficult to bear. Basically, what it boils down to is the mind not being okay with things as they are. The mind somehow or another resisting things as they are, wanting things to be different. And it causes you to act out of greed, and out of attachment, out of aversion, and out of delusion, out of ignorance, ignorance, not wanting to see things the way they are. So when you look back on something you said that was hurtful or destructive or that was self-defeating, it was not altogether true, that and then what you can do is you can reflect on the intentions that underlay what you said. And a little space begins to appear, because who you were at the time that you said what you did and who you are now. Who you are now is somebody who's looking back at who you were then and what you did. And having that little bit of space, not taking the whole thing quite so personally, allows for a couple of things to take place in your own mind. One is self-forgiveness. oh gracious, you know, I was really hurting when I did that, or I was really mad, or I was really, you know, deeply depressed, or whatever it was that was going on. And so you can feel a little bit of kindness to yourself for the predicament that you were in the same time. Also, if you have been doing this practice and getting insights into all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who you are in the present moment, then you can sometimes see the connection between all of that conditioning and why you acted in the way you did. You know, a lot of us have thought patterns and emotional response patterns that are really deeply embedded as a result of our life experience, and oftentimes some kind of traumatic event or something in the past that causes us to reflectively think or act or see things in a certain way that can then also cause us to say things, you know, reflexively, that and say them before the mind has an opportunity to really reflect on whether it's a good thing to do or not. So does anything I've said so far this evening resonate? What were some of the things you were hearing between your ears while you were sitting this evening? What are some of your, please?
I just thought it was kind of funny today, that PGA golf tournament was on. They were talking with Jack Nicklaus. They asked Jack Nicklaus who his greatest competitor through all the years was. And he said, myself.
Did he elaborate at all?
No, that was it.
Yeah.
He wasn't there. It's a well-known thing that he said. Kind of got everybody going.
Yeah, it's good, right? Mahatma Gandhi, on the eve of India's independence, I was being interviewed by all these news, you know, newspaper reporters from around the world, and asking him to recount his struggles when starting out in South Africa, struggles with the British and others, and so they asked him, well, what was it like interacting with you know, this or that general or some of the politicians, your own party that you have difficulty with, and how you managed to negotiate to get where we were, and he would talk about how he could usually gain some insight into the mind of the other, just like we were talking about, that would enable him to speak to that in them that was hurting and that was resistant. And he said, yes, I find that through those insights, I'm able to have some influence with those with whom I negotiate, and that helped us get where we are. He said, but there's this one person, this fellow Mohandas K. Gandhi, with him I have very little influence. Just the same thing, you know, that he found that he was, in some ways, you know, his own greatest adversary sometimes. So that's why it's useful to learn how to listen with insight and compassion to these voices that arise. Right? And the reason is because how you listen to and speak to other people inevitably is influenced by how we listen to and speak to ourselves. Right? Because the mindsets, you know, if you have created this mindset for yourself and your relationship for yourself, that becomes a pattern that then plays out in how you relate to others as well. You know, when I'm kind of getting into some kind of testy interaction with my wife, it's usually because she's pointing out something about myself that I know to be an issue. And so instead of being my, you know, usual bodhisattva self, you know, I tend to get incredibly defensive depending on what my state of mind is in the moment. If I'm already feeling, you know, iffy about myself, or I'm already giving myself a hard time about something, and then she points it out, it's like it plays into it. And so what happens then is what had been a sort of an unpleasant internal dialogue suddenly gets blown up into an interaction between the two of us, you know. And of course, the longer you are with another, a significant other, the more you learn about where all of the buttons are and what all the internal dialogues that the other person has going on. And we get very good, again, talking about, you know, if it's not beneficially intended speech for whatever reason, we can get very adept at setting off the other, you know. And then say, oh, well, I'm sorry you took that the way you did, you know. You don't have to be defensive when I tell you what a jerk you are, you know. Open up, listen up, right. So, anyway, this fascinating relationship between how we listen to and speak to ourselves and others is just, it's a rich one. It's really worthy of investigation.
I'm reading a very wonderful book, and the title is Dignity.
That's what?
Dignity.
Dignity. Right.
I think her name is Harris, Dorothy Harris. Mm-hmm. And she was a principal negotiator. And in the early years of many conflicts, and she was doing investigations into why people couldn't come to the table.
Yeah.
And what was driving those conflicts. And the operative word that she is focused on in this book is dignity. If you are unable to give the space, the dignity that it needs, and the individuals the dignity that they need, you cannot make progress. You have to be open to that dignity. And it's resonated with me, especially on my internal conversations. So many times I fail to recognize that this little creature here deserves the dignity that sometimes I don't want to give.
Yes. Right. To live with integrity. Mm-hmm. You know, the Buddhist talked about, when he talked about what he called conceit, and what he meant by that was self-conceiving. He said, when we are in a state of conceit, which is a form of self-construction, that we tend to see ourselves as either better than the other, superior to the other, or inferior to the other, or sometimes equal to the other. Okay. And he said they're all unfortunate misconceptions because they are all predicated on the idea of an I and an other. And instead, if there really is no I and there is no other, then we all simply inhabit this unified field, which can be either a rich, nutritive, free, and open one, if that sense of dignity and respect for the space that we share is there, or it can be toxic, and it can be violent and prone to all kinds of difficult dualistic, you know, events occurring, you know, depending on how we're seeing what's going on. He said, absolutely, the sort of the starting point for our ability to be each other in be with each other in a kind and supportive way is being able to be kind and supportive to ourselves. It's the beginning of it all. And yeah, nice work if you can get it. Yeah. But the I think the richness of the Buddha Dharma and the insights that come from doing this kind of work is that what you do, the more you do the practice, the better able you become at watching mind construct self. Okay. At watching mind construct self, at watching mind construct the other. And the more adept we become at that, the less likely the mind is to fall into self-destructive selfing. When the Dalai Lama would talk about it, he'd say, you know, these qualities of the Brahmaviharas, like joy, and, selfless joy, he said, they are a birthright. They are, you know, they are, and there's a book by, I think there's something here, Pashir Tarthantopo. It's called Carefree Dignity. It's all about that. That when you are able to let go of self, that there is a certain kind of inherent dignity that arises, you know, in this very letting go, you know, when these beneficial qualities of the heart mind start to come forward, you know, of compassion for self and other, of selfless joy, of equanimity, of open-heartedness, they have a dignifying effect. You know, they cause us to live with more sort of nobility. You know, you used to talk about noble ones, noble friends, noble ideas. That's what he meant by that. You know, that natural kind of nobility that comes from being able to live in a way that you're not always creating and defending the self. Absolutely. Okay. Other observations people have? Yes, please.
I was wondering, as I'm looking and trying to make space for being more aware of my intentions, so far it's just taking more time and checking in. But are there other practices that might be supportive?
For
checking in with your intentions.
With intentions?
On a more regular basis, just moment to moment.
Yes. Well, practices. When you say that, you know, you find things sort of slowing down, you know, for me, one of the most beneficial aspects of this is, in fact, the process of slowing down. Just doing that, that's not a problem, you know. I think what the Buddha was actually encouraging us to do in terms of mental activity is, in fact, to slow down. You know, Bhante Gunaratana in his book, What is the one that we used before to call young media groups and whatnot? Mindfulness in Plain English, was that? Yeah. You know, he's saying essentially what goes on when we're doing insight meditation practice is that it slows down the rate of mental activity at the same time it's speeding up the rate of attention. So we're getting more and more in touch with what's going on in the mind on a moment-to-moment basis. Okay. And the more we can slow down the rate of activity, the less likely we are to blow it. Because we can see it coming. And call it what it is and not act on it. And that a lot of that becomes possible when we just slow down. Right? And don't move at quite the same mental pace, because when we're just ripping along, you know, if you're in a heated conversation, oftentimes you're not really listening to the other person. You're waiting for them to shut up so you can say what you want to say, right? And that's just alternative talking. That's not a conversation. So to have a conversation, usually you have to slow down. There has to be some open spaces in there, right? And that goes to intention. Do you want to have a conversation, or you just want to lay your views on somebody else? Yeah, it's a lot. Other observations, thoughts, reflections? Very well then. Let's settle back into our sitting posture. listen to an ancient voice, beneficially intended.
Bhavatu sabha mangalam, rakantu sabha devatam.
May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you.
Sabha Buddha Nubhavina Sala Sodeva Vandupe.
Through the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well.
Bhavantu Sabha Mangalam Rakantu Sabha Devata.
May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you.
Sabha Dhamma Nubhavena Sala Sodeva Vandute.
Through the power of all the Dhammas, may you always be well.
Bhavantu Sabha Mangalam Rakantu Sabha Devata.
May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you.
Sabha Sangha Nubhavena Sabha Sodeva Vandute.
Through the power of all the Sangha, may you always be well. May you create in your mind a place of refuge. May your own innate self-compassion, self-restraint, equanimity, open-heartedness, create in your heart-mind the place of refuge from which we go forth, speak and act with wisdom, and live with integrity. May we be happy, may we be peaceful, may we be awakened. Thanks for coming around tonight. Have a safe journey.